Welcome back to another episode of the Textual Talk Podcast. In today's episode, HD sits down with cybersecurity leader Irvin McBride for an in-depth, relatable conversation about breaking into the world of compliance and building a thriving career in cybersecurity. Irvin shares his unconventional journey from computer science major, SOC analyst, compliance specialist, and ultimately to a high-earning GRC consultant making around $200,000 a year. You'll hear how Irvin navigated career pivots, tackled imposter syndrome, upskilled with certifications, and the real-world challenges that come with securing organizations both big and small. The two also get candid about working in tech hotspots like Atlanta, Dallas, and New Jersey and discuss everything from project management rotations to advanced AI security risks. Plus, HD and Irvin dive into third-party risks, business continuity, the realities of compliance audits, and what it really takes to succeed. Whether you're starting from scratch or looking to make the leap into consulting, you'll walk away with practical advice for building your GRC and cybersecurity skill set, along with the insightful takes on the future of AI governance and why soft skills are just as critical as technical chops. Whether you're aspiring to get in GRC, curious about high-paying roles in cybersecurity, or a seasoned pro looking for relatable stories and actionable tips, this episode is packed with inspiration and real talk to help you guide your next career steps. Stay tuned and let's get into the episode. Today's video is sponsored by Aura, and it's a really important time to be talking about them because hackers may have stolen the Social Security numbers of every American. Over 2.9 billion records were stolen from the National Public Data, which provides personal information to employers and others doing background checks. These stolen records include a person's full name, address, date of birth, phone number, and most importantly, Social Security number. And members of the hacker group have reportedly released this information for free online. Now, this could be incredibly dangerous to you because people can open up all different type of things in your name and you won't even know it. If you weren't taking precautions with your personal information online before this, then this should be a huge wake-up call. You've never been more vulnerable online than you are right now. But I'm not too worried about that because I use Aura. Aura monitors your personal data, including your social security number, across billions of data points like the dark web and public court records to detect and alert you to potential identity theft. They give you up to $5 million in identity theft insurance should the worst case scenario happen. They also provide a bunch of other features to keep you safe online, all inside one app. You can go to my link right now, aura.com/textualchatter, to try 14 days for free. That'll be enough time for Aura to find out if any of your personal data is exposed. I highly recommend you do this right now because not only is the National Public Data not going to do anything to help you, they probably aren't even going to face any repercussions for this leak. I'm not leaving myself and my family vulnerable to data breaches. If you don't want it either, you can go to aura.com/textualchatter to try 2 weeks for free. Now back to the video. Welcome back to the Textual Talk Podcast. I'm your host, HD. And we got another guest for you guys, none other than Mr. Irvin McBride. All the way here from the VA, and he came to kick it with us today in downtown Dallas. But first and foremost, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, please follow the podcast, leave us a review, it'll help us out in the analytics. And if you're still on the video right now, all you gotta do is hit the like button. You can subscribe later. But man, we've been kicking it a little bit beforehand, but I was like trying to intro the pod. You know what I'm saying? I was like, "See, now I got them relaxed, and we
got me, tapped in. I'm seeped into this seat. I am just here."
Yeah, I mean that's the magic behind it. A lot of people are always like, "Man, like you was asking me about Chris earlier. Me and Chris did our episode, but before that, I did an episode with a mutual person.
Yeah,
he was like, "Man, you pulled some stuff out of her that I couldn't." I was just like, I've been doing it for so long, before doing podcasting, people always had a level of comfort with me where they disclose stuff. So I was like, it's just translated over into here. So
yeah,
that's kind of how it is. But for the people who haven't seen you on social media anyway, like, could you just go ahead and give a brief background on yourself?
I mean, what can I say? I'm a cybersecurity extraordinaire. No, I'm just playing. Very humble, actually. But aspiring cybersecurity leader, like Henry said, all the way from the Virginia area, went to school at the illustrious North Carolina A&T State University. Shout out to my Aggies if y'all are watching right now. You know, super, super passionate about being in the cybersecurity industry. You know, been trying to take my talents to another level. You know, being able to share more of my insight, share more of my vision, and really out here to inspire each and every one of you that are looking to get into the space or continue to grow in this space. You know, I think that for me, when I walked into cybersecurity, I looked at it as, you know, a job, somewhere that will always have some type of sustainability, just because, you know, everybody wants to be in a state of security and have, like, you know, to know that they're in a space where the money that they're making is going to continue to come in. But I've been able to look at it from a different aspect of saying, like, wow, like, security is really like the modern day self-defense. Like, I mean, if you don't know about it, you're putting yourself at risk. You're putting the people that you love and the people that you like and even the people you don't like at risk, right? So at the end of the day, it's for me to spread this word and continue to allow people to understand what it is and how to protect themselves day in and day out. So just an aspiring cybersecurity leader, continue to grow, continue to impact the people. That's all I can say.
Bet. Now, I will tell you this. In the words of Deontay Wilder, speak it, believe it, receive it.
Absolutely.
We got to take that aspiring off.
Absolutely.
We already got to see ourselves as a leader. So I am a cybersecurity leader. Like, that's me. Like, funny enough, on my LinkedIn, I think I have like either something, somewhere I'm working at a SOC or something like that. I mean, even one of my roles, I changed to the SOC manager because I was like, only thing I wasn't doing was they weren't reporting to me. But actually, other than that, I was managing this team.
Facts.
So I was like, but your background wasn't traditionally going to be in cybersecurity.
Nah, not necessarily.
What did you initially go to school to major in?
So, you know, this was a time before cybersecurity was like hot in the streets. You know, this, when I think about it, a lot of people were like more entertained with the idea of like information technology or IT. When I went to school, I got my undergrad degree in computer science. So, you know, with all those things being said, I knew the curriculum for me wasn't for me. You know, by the grace of God, I got through a lot of programming, a lot of coding, things that I really didn't like to do. You know, after that, I had opportunities to do like internships. So did database administration, did IT help desk, did software engineering. And I was like, a lot of different avenues you can take within computer science, but none of those things stuck to me. It really took me to get my first internship at the city of Greensboro, actually free internship at that. Did the work for free. They didn't want no compensation, just wanted, you know, the opportunity to gain some exposure. And they started me off doing like some IT help desk stuff and then made a transition to do some, I think they called it information security or IT security at the time. However they phrased it, they said, yeah, just check these URLs to see if they're malicious or not. And I don't know, it wasn't sexy work at all. It was literally like taking a list of URLs and plugging them into, you know, a system to understand, you know, what kind of feedback I'm going to get, whether it's a bad link or a good link. And I thought to myself, like, oh, this is doable. It's manageable. I feel like I'm providing an impact, you know, for those people that might be clicking on those bad links, which we'll probably touch on a little bit today. But that's been something that's been happening for quite some time, and, you know, it's continued to evolve. But I've seen the value in being in this particular space. I think at the time when I had the internship, large corporations like Sony and like Target had got hacked. So I'm like, if these big corporations are having these issues, then I'm thinking, you know, fast forward as we continue to grow and elevate in emerging technologies, it's going to be some opportunities in this space. And so my long-winded answer, that was that. But essentially, you know, computer science made the idea that, you know, programming wasn't it. Cybersecurity, fell in love with it, thought it'd be, you know, good for the pockets because, you know, there's some money in this space, and, you know, kind of took off from there.
For sure. Now, I know before you got your first role, like, technically that wasn't an internship. Mm-hmm. You did some project and product management.
Yeah.
How did that come about, from like managing in computer science to getting in, you know, project management? And I believe these were also like non-technical project and product management roles, right?
That is correct. So, you know, I love to tell my story. I love to, you know, take it from, you know, top to bottom. Like I said, we just transitioned into understanding what happened during school, right? So post-graduation, got into a rotational program, actually AT&T. So, you know, in Dallas right now, we're recording. It's really nostalgic that I'm able to kind of like fast forward rewind back in time and think like, wow, 2017, when I had moved out here for my first time, you know, that was my entry level opportunity, rotation program. Amazing. I always, you know, encourage those that are looking or don't know exactly what they want to do to get into those type of programs because it gives you so much exposure. You get a chance to meet leadership, and it gives you a better understanding of what you think you want to do, because sometimes we go into a role thinking we're going to be passionate about it, and not always we think like, all right, this was it. This is everything I prayed for and I thought it was going to be. Like, no, it gave you opportunity to jump around a little bit. So got into that rotation program. Like you said, did those project management and product marketing roles, and it was good. I think that for that particular program that I was in, it specialized in cybersecurity. Okay. So although those roles weren't technical cybersecurity roles, they gave me a good foundation of cybersecurity outside of the technicalities. Starting off with the product marketing aspect, it was good because it gave me a good business orientation when it came down to cybersecurity. So I had supported it might be different at this time, but it was like the marketing group for their cybersecurity solutions. So when it had went to market to understand like how to kind of drive the sales of like the different solutions they had to be able to, you know, be that, that trusted advisor, you know, in some cases, or that trusted partner for some companies when it came down to the way that they were pivoting with the different solutions they had. I mean, back then, I think mobile security was really hot. IoT security was just kind of like kicking off. So that's a team that I had supported both of them actually. And it did some other different stuff too. But yeah, that was the product marketing side of it. So just good to just see how we organize it from a business perspective. And then project management, had a chance to lead a network security project that was focusing on DDoS capabilities. And so I thought that was really keen. I always thought to myself, like, I want to be a project manager. This is going to be perfect. I had made a pivot actually to Atlanta for my next rotation, and I enjoyed it, but it was, for some reason, I'm not sure if it's that particular project, but it was just too, it was too subtle for me. It was no excitement. I didn't gain a lot of it other than like managing people. You know, it's when people hear project management, the misconception is that you're managing a project. No, you're actually managing those relationships, managing the attitudes, managing the people that want to and don't want to get the job done. So I enjoyed it. But like I said, I just knew it wasn't really like for me. Second note of that, actually, I had an opportunity once the project had ended. I still had some time within that particular rotation, so I actually started to do some RPA, robotic process automation is what it's called. And funny enough, a lot of people talk about AI today, and RPA has like a small piece of that when you think about, you know, creating like different tasks. And I had to tap into, you know, my background in programming to understand and, you know, to tell the computer to do certain tasks to achieve that will allow us as, you know, employees to step away from doing some of those manual day-to-day tasks, allowing a tool or, you know, a computer to actually do those for us, and being able to increase the productivity to do some other complex tasks. So enjoy both roles, but like I said, just wasn't exactly, my end all be all.
Cool. Yeah. You said a lot. For example, one, I just released, well, not last week, but the week before that, I released the PMP, well, not the PMP episode, but about project management.
Okay. Okay.
And one of the things that Veronica was talking about was like how people don't realize, hey, this is a leadership role.
Yeah.
And you're going to be doing exactly what you said, managing those relationships and the how to figure out, you know, those blockers and things like that to make sure that the project is going on. And then second one, you was talking about RPA. I did an episode on RPA with my guy AD, RPA University.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I think that was pretty interesting that you brought that up. I didn't expect you to even talk about RPA.
Well, you know, I didn't know what we was going to talk about today. I mean, I knew a little bit, but, yeah. You know, it's so much that I don't really, like, share a lot until it, like, just comes to mind. And I'm like, you know what? I'm a good storyteller. I like to tell the full story, and then it might, you know, kind of jog some memory. And I'm like, you know, let me hone in on that a little bit. So, you know, I'm just glad to be able to talk about it a little bit. Now, if you ask me all the technicalities of it, if you ask me to do what I did, you know, almost 10 years ago, I'm like, you might lose me right there.
We'll leave that for them to learn from AD. If y'all want to learn that, go to the RPA episode where AD was talking about RPA and helping people get into RPA, changing their lives and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, that's tough.
All right, so I didn't even know at the time you had moved to Atlanta. How was that for you? How was that? I feel like that would have been like, you know, your bag with going to like NCAT and everything else.
I love the A. I love the A. You know, if I get another opportunity to live in Atlanta, I probably will take it for sure. I think a lot of the places that I live, I've lived so many different places, but every place that I've lived, I've been able to, at some aspect, call it home, you know. But Atlanta has a very strong place in my heart, you know, when it comes down to, you know, Black excellence, you know, seeing a lot of, like, you know, people that look like me that's doing very well for themselves. I'll say, like, Atlanta kind of gave me that aspect to be able to step out of my comfort zone, right? And I say that because when I came from, you know, being undergrad and, you know, going to entry level, you know, situation, and even like in my project management aspect, like I'm working with people that's been in a role for 15, 20 years, mm-hmm. you know, and so on. So it's like, how can you really instruct or really like guide someone that's been doing this longer than you, you know? So I will be honest to say, I definitely had that imposter syndrome while I was out there. But, you know, being in places like Atlanta, you know, where I'm seeing so many Black leaders being able to exercise, you know, their, you know, ability to lead teams and lead organizations really helped me to grow, you know, because, you know, once you see it, you can achieve it, you know?
Yeah. I'm surprised you made out of Atlanta not having you like a wife or something.
God, look, you know, honestly, Atlanta definitely has a lot of attractive.
I feel like they just throw it at you.
Women, you know,
they got so much competition.
Yeah, yeah, it's a lot going on out there in Atlanta. Like I said, it's a lot of very, very beautiful and attractive women, and I mean, I think it's like that a lot of places, but very, very much so in Atlanta for sure. You, it's one of those things where I'm surprised I left without a wife too. So. But I'm sure God got something for me one day, you know. We ain't going to rush the process, but, you know, I'm going to keep tapping in. And, you know, maybe one day I might come back to the show and be like, yeah, man, I mean, you know, I just got engaged or something like that. So we'll see.
I low-key been wanting to do a dating tech thing just to be funny.
Yeah.
Whatever. I mean, I know a lot of eligible bachelors and women. And I was like, but that, you know what's funny? It don't always work because of similar mindset, similar job titles. Sometimes it works best to talk to somebody that's not in tech at all.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that. I mean, it's funny you say that because, you know, as I, you know, continue to understand what I seek in a partner, you know, one of the things that I thought about is somebody I can grow with, somebody that gets it, you know. I mean, especially, you know, sometimes being in cybersecurity is not a 9-to-5 type of situation. You know, sometimes you have those times where you got to stay longer and mm-hmm. you got to have the right person that is able to kind of like understand that. You know, outside of that particular piece, you know, you got like so many different layers when it comes down to like finding like, you know, your person. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, as much as I would say, you know, a woman that's in cybersecurity or in tech or somebody that just was on their grind and really can get it, you know, might be, you know, it could be good, but at the same time, you know, who knows? We'll see. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's stories where it works out and, you know, when it doesn't work out, but who knows? Yeah,
for sure. All right. So the next job, you finally say, you know what? I'm finna try to get on the front line. So you went and worked at the SOC.
Mm-hmm.
How was that? How was it actually getting into the trenches? How was that?
Getting into the trenches for sure. You know, honestly, so I was in Atlanta. I thought I was going to be going back to Dallas. I thought I was going to somehow get a chance to, I was so passionate about getting into consulting. And like, I did everything I possibly could to try to get into consulting. Like I had learned more information. I was, you know, trying to get like certifications. I was, you know, building my network. I was, you know, shaking hands and kissing babies, doing all the things just to get into this particular situation, and it didn't work out.
You were trying to consult at AT&T or
Big Four? So I did consult in Big Four, but, you know, prior to that, I was trying to consult AT&T because they had, a consulting branch, you know, for cybersecurity. And I remember, like, I was trying to do everything I possibly could, and no opportunity was opening up. And I was distraught. I was like, wow, okay. So what y'all got for me? They told me I was moving to New Jersey. I said, excuse me? I said, New Jersey? And the kicker is I was in this rotation program. So, you know, what they had paid you was what they paid you. It won't no increase of salary depending on, like, where you went. So imagine, you know, you got different tiers when it comes to different companies and locations. Mm-hmm. And so Dallas could have been like, or Atlanta could have been, you know, within the same tier, like maybe like a tier two or a tier three, you know. So Jersey's going to be like a tier one or a tier two, you know, because mm-hmm. it's like right there to New York. So, you know, at the time, I remember I was paying maybe like, probably close to like $1,200 in rent. You know, that shows you like how times is really gone. Like, you, I missed that.
I was saying, look, at the around the same time, I think I was paying like $1,000 to Frisco.
That's what I'm saying. So I stayed close in the city. I was paying like, you know, $1,200 and, you know, kind of going into it, moving to New Jersey. I'm like, how much I'm about to be paying out here? And like, yeah, my apartment was like 19 for one bedroom. I said, come on now. Like, you know,
give me a stipend or
something. give me something. But it was no work around. It was like, you know, you're just going to make it work, you know. And for me, like, I'm a person that, like, always, when I put my mind to something, I don't like backing out on it. It's, I don't know. It must be just, like, an internal thing that I do personally. But I like to stay set in the things that I sign up for. So I was like, all right, we're moving to New Jersey. And that probably was, like, the best time for me. Not, like, that I had fun, but, like, it really helped me, like, grow because I, like, spent so much time alone. And like, I mean, Dallas, I had a good network. You know, Atlanta had a good network. And New Jersey, I literally knew like nobody, you know. So like, it was a lot of like trying to figure it out. I had friends that were like from, you know, New Jersey that was plugging me in with different people and different folks. And, you know, over time, you know, I was able to kind of like build a community out there and really figure everything out. And then, you know, 2020, COVID happened. So everybody in the house.
Everybody remote.
Everybody's remote. I remember my boss at the time, he was like, listen, take your laptop. he gave me like a monitor. Like, yeah, take your monitor home. He was like, yeah, we don't know how long we're going to be gone. I'm thinking it's been like 2 weeks. You already know how the pandemic was set up. So, but yeah, just thinking about more of my time in the SOC. You know, for those that don't know what the SOC is, Security Operations Center, it's, like you said, frontline defense, you know, really we call it like blue teaming, you know, they still use that line these days, right? If I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So being able to really be that defense mechanism for a lot of organizations. So we use this, platform called USM Anywhere, which is a SIM tool or a security information event management tool for those that aren't aware. And I mean, it works typically like the high end tools that you see today, like the Splunks and, you know, some of the other different vendors. But, you know, literally started off, you know, just like kind of like doing like ticketing, like you see an alert come in and you figuring out if it's benign or malicious activity. And, you know, from there, like, where do you go next? So I was tier one support. Mm-hmm. And as tier one, you know, you see everything come in and then. If it was malicious, of course, it got escalated to like my tier threes. They were a little bit more of the seasonal experts to kind of like delve into mm-hmm. the process. And then, but if it wasn't malicious, then, you know, I'm just letting the customer know, you know, like, you know, just make sure you're monitoring your environment for anything. But I've seen a lot of like, brute force, you know, a lot of instances where it seemed like people were either trying to like get in or a lot of like failed login attempts. Mm-hmm. And you like, all right, if this is happening in a 50, you know, 50 different login attempts within the past, you know, 2 minutes, like it's got to be something going on versus if it's somebody that, you know, might have failed login maybe like 3 or 4 times. It might be somebody just like literally like forgot their password. So seen a lot of that. You know, it was crazy, but I enjoyed my time in the SOC. I just thought that for me, I had so much more to offer. Like, I wanted to be more public facing. I wanted to be able to actually like work with people, like helping them solve their issues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the SOC gives you that opportunity, but it gives you that from, you know, being behind the scenes, you know. And I don't know, like being in like cybersecurity, I think for us, like I've learned that soft skills is a really very, very, very important skill to have. And a lot of people don't really possess that. But I love that I'm able to really talk and connect to, you know, the business, whether, you know, it's leadership or, you know, the engineer, just being able to be that liaison to be able to break down that, that technical jargon.
Yeah, I figured that's why I was like, when I was working for the MSS, I was like our lead.
Sure.
So I talked to a lot to my contemporaries on the other side for the clients. Mm-hmm, so I was a lot. And I was like this past year, I was like this close to getting an actual security advisor role.
Oh, nice.
With a security company, but I didn't fall through.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is what it is. One of the things that I didn't ask you, and I forgot to ask you when you mentioned the rotational program, is like coming out of school, what did the rotational program pay you?
Yeah, yeah. So when I was thinking about it, I started off at 70K. Mm-hmm. Started off at 70K. I was living in Dallas, so, you know, no kids, no, you know, no wife, just me. It was decent. It was decent. You know what I'm saying? This was, you know, 2017. So, you know, almost 10 years ago, the market was a lot different. You know, typically, I had moved back to Dallas. We'll talk about that. But I remember I was paying, you know, I talked about $1,200 in rent. And that $1,200 probably went up to, you know, if you stay in the inner city, you playing close to like $2,000. You know, so
probably won't now.
Yeah, yeah. So the jump is crazy. But at the time, 70K, you know, in that rotation. And I had made, I'm not sure what happened, but when I moved to Atlanta, they had to do like some reevaluation of like the comp and stuff. I think, I guess a lot of people were like leaving or weren't happy. And, you know, for us, you know, as millennials, you know, we don't get a lot of time. Well, we don't stay places like too long. We try to get in to get what we need, and then we try to make a movement. So I guess for them to make it a little bit more of an enticing opportunity, I know, I remember how I got a raise that was like, somehow I jumped to like 85, like when I was in Atlanta. So I was like, okay, like this is cool. Like, I mean, I can do this. And then somehow I remember when I moved to Jersey, I was making like a little bit over 90 or at 90, I'm not mistaken. Okay. So again, like, you know, close to six figures, but not close enough. But, and like I said, just being in Jersey, it was a lot more expensive to be out there. So you had to really figure it out.
Yeah. How often did you go to New York?
I love New York. So I went to the city probably like, if not, definitely won't every weekend. I don't even want to say that. But it could have been like probably like twice a month at the most. But at least once a month for sure. It was funny because, you know, they got the New Jersey Transit. So I used to go hop on a train, go to New York, and it's nothing, you know. But you go to other cities, like being on public transportation, it's like, you know, where they do that at? You know, but cities like that, I mean, it's, you know, it's just how they do things, you know. So used to get on the transit, you know, go to New York for the day, come back, you know, all this, you know, peace and quiet, you know, because the city, New York, they never sleep out there. Yeah. But I enjoyed it out there for sure, for sure.
Did you ever go visit Connecticut?
I've been to Connecticut like one time, but I think it was more like a passing through type of situation. Like I never like haven't spent like a ton of time. What's going on in Connecticut?
Oh, so like our headquarters is in Stanford.
Okay.
So
like okay.
Once a year we go out to Stanford and meet up and stuff. And so my first time out there 2 years ago, we took the train to the Grand Central to New York.
Okay. Okay.
And
yeah.
To the
yeah.
office in Manhattan. So yeah. I mean, it was cool. We went on, you know, that tall building, that's that World Trade Center building, mm-hmm, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you get the very top and it's freaking ears popping and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
You can see Jersey and everything. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So we went there and it's, I mean, it was cool. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of New York.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, I know why people in New York are always rude and mad. They squashed in.
Yeah, yeah, that's funny. And me living out there too, because I mean, I'm a Southern guy at heart, you know, so I've lived like so many different places and how to really understand, because I got friends in New York. Shout out to y'all. But, you know, one of the things I've noticed is that everybody just really minds their business. Like, aim for all the extra stuff. Like, you know, you might ask for directions and that's might be all you get. Don't be asking, you know, extra questions. Like, why are you trying to be all in my business? You know, everybody's just like to themselves out there. You know, I think that over time, New York has had a lot more transplants, of course. You know what I'm saying? Since it's like a really like big city. So I think everybody typically would still kind of like keep to themselves, but you know, nevertheless, you know, New York is always love.
Bet. And before we get off the sock stuff, do you remember any type of like maybe big investigations you were part of?
Yeah.
Talk at a high level about that.
Yeah, yeah. I that was one of the things I was thinking about. I actually was working with one of the leads at the time. He had actually wrote a white paper about this particular stuff. So I actually got this. This was published back in like 2018, 2019, something like that. So if y'all ever search my name, y'all will probably like see that come up. But yeah, you gonna check it out. Check it out. I'll be honest with you. I can't recall like everything that particularly happened in that particular event, but I will say that you know, we use a lot of different tools like OSINT to really determine like what's really going on. And OSINT is a really big, a good tool to use. That's really popular. It's still using that today?
Yeah.
Not too. Okay.
Is this, wait, is the guy named Andrew?
Andrew. Yeah.
Luco,
Yeah. So he's, you know, because AT&T, they did like the shift. They were AT&T Cybersecurity, and I think they had got acquired by a company called Level Blue. This might have happened like a few years ago.
Oh, that's Level Blue. I was thinking about another company that's in a co-working office that I work in. Mm-hmm. I think they're like Security Blue or something. I was thinking it was them. I was like, let me come knock on their door.
Oh, okay. But I mean, I think just bottom line, use a lot of tools to just really understand like what was really happening in someone's environment. And from that point on, you know, wrote a white paper about it to kind of like produce and give people understanding of, you know, how AT&T SOC, you know, is pretty legit, but also, you know, can also give people an understanding of like what happens in the day to day and like why cybersecurity is really like so important, you know? So,
yeah. Did you guys have, well, it was a while back, but like, you know, some company security teams have podcasts.
Okay. Yeah, no, they weren't really doing a lot of podcasts. I think that a lot of the communications could have been like more internal, but they weren't doing like a lot of like external, like let's talk about it aspects. Times could have changed though, but you know, I was probably going by that time.
Yeah, Yahoo, well, their paranoid teams, their security team, they were talking about the Log4j incident.
I was around during that time. Yeah. I wasn't working in the SOC though. I was working in the compliance piece.
Yeah, and that's actually what the pivot into was like going from SOC to working in compliance. And I guess I also add on to compliance is like compliance seems like such a high level term, right? Like, in that role, exactly what were you doing?
What was I not doing? So I think that the bottom line that everybody has to understand with compliance is that if you're not compliant, it can cause a lot of issues, not only with your organization. It can cause issues with your partners or your vendors, the people that you're working with. And then it also can cause like regulation issues, you know, working with different companies. Like, I mean, you know, when companies get breached these days, you know, that SEC, like they come down real, real hard on you, you know? So, just thinking about those particular pieces, you know, compliance is one of those things where you have to always, 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 and I hate to say this word, but you always have to make sure the boxes are checked. And you gotta, cross your T's and dot your I's, but, as for me and my roles, responsibilities with compliance, I had got exposed to so much. So, you know, just kind of taking a step back, product marketing, project management, security operations center. So, you know, did the technical work, did the non-technical work. And with all those things being said, I was able to formulate a better understanding of what cybersecurity is and how cybersecurity should work because I had some of that technical aspect of like, being in, you know, not as an engineer, but working with different engineers and working with different people that, you know, are literally trying to do their job to ensure that things are working appropriately. But then, you know, from a non-technical standpoint, you're working with other people that are making some of those decisions. And sometimes it's a tough opportunity because, you know, everybody thinks that their part is a little bit more important. And so for me, I had to be more of a liaison to be able to say, like, from a technical standpoint, this is what I'm seeing. And from a non-technical standpoint, this is what decision they want to make and trying to make that better decision for them. But I worked on a lot of different things like policy creation, creating like procedures, user access reviews. That was probably one of my least favorite because it took so much time to do. One of the other things I did was like risk assessments. Go ahead.
Keep on.
Oh, yeah. I did some third-party risk management work. I think one of the things I can say I'm most proud of is building the security awareness training program for the year that stretched across three different business units. So that was really key. And then did some other stuff as well to really support the business. But, yeah, man, love my time in compliance. Oh, I mean, talked about all these things I did, but I had to ensure that we were ready for external audit, right? So did some internal audit stuff during that particular time to prepare for the external audit. So when we had to get compliant with, you know, our SOC 2, you know, our PCI, our HIPAA regulations, you know, we had a third-party vendor to come in to assess us from those particular requirements, had to make sure that all those boxes were checked. And I hate saying that when it comes to security. So y'all don't hurt me too bad after this, all right?
I mean, that's doing your job. And I'm glad you actually answered the questions about what you guys had to be compliant to, because I was going to ask, like, what different frameworks for a telecom company did they have to adhere to? I mean, of course, everybody's HIPAA than the other stuff. Funny enough, you mentioned third-party risk.
Well, I love it. I love third-party risk.
Okay. scenario time.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar, but I reported, it really technically was, last week. Even though I dropped it this week.
Okay.
The global grocery distributor, UNFI.
Okay.
They distribute food to a lot of companies, but in particular, they were breached. And this led to Whole Foods not being able to get their shipments because pretty much this is a supply chain issue at this time. Risk assessment.
Yeah.
Now, in my mind, I said, okay, they were not thinking about disaster recovery or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Contingency plans, right? Business
continuity.
There we go. Yeah, continuity. I'm like, okay, in situations like that, when you plan out, if something should happen to this distributor, we should have a backup distributor.
Yeah.
And it seems like they don't have a backup distributor.
Mm-hmm.
So for risk assessments, is that kind of stuff that y'all do? Is like, okay, if this happens, then this, if this, 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 and this.
You know, that's a good question. When it comes down to like conducting a risk assessment, we understand what are the probable cause of the risk and understanding what are the consequences and the severity levels to give you a better understanding of the risk organization, excuse me, the risk to the organization. Now, the misconception is that a lot of people believe that when you have risk that you should get it all off your plate. And that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, that's never going to happen. You have to understand for your organization, what type of risk appetite do you guys have? You know, what are you able to take on? And what are you able to say? These are manageable risks that we can, you know, have, you know, and are we looking to accept, you know, because, you know, you have the four different components, the mitigation piece, which is, you know, ending it all. You got the accepting piece, being able to say, you know, we accept to the terms and conditions. You have the transference piece, which is also called, you know, the risk sharing, you know, being able to have the insurance in case anything happens. And then you have the avoidance piece, which is essentially like, we're gonna make sure that we ain't got to worry about this. So let's pull the rug with a lot of different things. But going back into your question, I believe that conducting a risk assessment just will give you a better understanding of what type of risks will come into place. But we wouldn't hone in on like the backup plans, because nobody's really ready, prepared for those type of backup situations. I mean, not to call out any organizations today, but, you know, we seen about a year ago with the CrowdStrike situation, how, you know, it was an evident opportunity to see that how so many organizations are built upon technology today. We leverage technology to the full scope of what it's supposed to do, which is supposed to make our lives more better. We're supposed to be able to use it to scale and create more efficiencies for our group. But when it's all stripped away, then what are we really left with, you know? And so, you know, going back to that particular breach that you had mentioned, I think that nobody ever is really ready for when a vendor that we partner with that is, you know, essential to our group, or a technology that we, you know, we have through a vendor is essential to, you know, our business is stripped away, are we really ready to have that conversation of what is the business continuity plan, you know, in that particular place? And a lot of people don't think that far ahead. They just think about, if we're in business, we operating, we're crossing our T's, dotting our I's, ensuring that everything is going the right direction. And, you know, job is done. But is it really done?
Right. And, oops, this thing's going on too much.
Nah, you could, you could.
While you were saying that, I stopped at the crash rate thing, but when that, I guess that's a risk acceptance. Simply because we know it's an issue with like no QA, but that definitely should be something that has to make sure it's compliant. That doesn't do something like that in the future.
Exactly. Exactly.
And from a GRC standpoint, how often do they bring you guys in when you're considering bringing a new tool in the environment? So like, for example, I'm on a blue team.
Yeah.
And we're always talking about different tools. So like if we're talking about, you know, we want to move to a different EDR. Maybe we want to move away from using something like a Tanium or CrowdStrike, and we want to use Defender.
Yeah.
Do you guys get looped in so you can figure out what's going on with Defender?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think that, security has always been an afterthought for a lot of organizations. A lot of people see a new tool and are happy to use this tool because it's going to do better than what they currently have or don't have, right?
Right.
It has to go through those particular streamlined processes to ensure that it's the tool is onboarded appropriately. So not only is, you know, the thought of bringing this tool on, you know, the first step, but really the first step is engaging your security team to understand what type of risk will it pose to the organization by bringing it on versus not bringing it on, you know. So kind of going back into that risk assessment piece, really being able to understand, you know, what it would, assuming the tool would do its job, but if it, you know, if we switch out, you know, how would it disrupt the business, if any, you know? But yeah, a lot of times we will understand like what type of new tools are we looking to bring in, and we're having those conversations because at the end of the day, our job is to make, well, and we're still talking about compliance, you know, my job is to ensure that we were maintaining the compliance aspect of it all. So
for sure. Yeah. And I think also when we think about it, everything's advancing so much, but we forget about the main three things that we worry about in cybersecurity, confidentiality, availability, and integrity. Like we always forget about those things, right, but this at the forefront of everything that we should consider when we're making our decision.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, going back to, you know, the aspect you talked about, third-party risks, you know, we're putting our trust in our vendors to ensure that they are doing the right things. And, you know, a lot of the times, you know, I work with organizations that the trust document is a SOC 2 report. You know, when we look at the SOC 2 report and we evaluate the security controls that they have in place, it gives us some type of, you know, ability to trust, because we're able to see based off of an independent assessor that they are not doing the right things.
Yeah.
You know, so shout out to the SOC 2 reports. they do a good job for us. But, you know, at the end of the day, we can't go into an organization or a vendor that we're looking to work with and say, you know, show me, you know, that you got, you know, your communication encrypted, or show me that, you know, you run vulnerability scans, you know, every 30 days or whatever the case may be. So, you know, we have to be able to lean in on the processes that's currently in place and really being able to trust the process within it.
Yeah. So that's essentially, because it's been a while since I've had someone that's the SOC 2 on here. Is that what that's about? Or just
controls? I've done a lot of that. Yeah, for sure.
Now, even though they listen them out, does that mean they implement it correctly?
That's a good caveat as well, because they'll have the controls listed. And it's crazy because, you know, I evaluate SOC 2 reports and I'll see, you see really three different sides of it. You know, you see they're either doing it, so it gives you four, normally four different columns. They give you the control objective, Which is like normally like a number. It could be like a number of letters situation. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they give you like a description of what type of control it is. And then after that, they tell you about like the testing objective, like how you actually like tested this particular control. Mm-hmm. And then they give you the end result of like what they was able to find within that. So a lot of the times they, you have companies that have like X amount of different employees. So they're going to take like a sample of your organization, mm-hmm. To ensure that this is going right. And it's all at random. So you don't know, but you're going to hope that, you know, with the tools and the processes you have in place that, you know, everyone is, has been accounted for. And so when you go through that particular piece on that right hand side, when it talks about it, it's either going to say that this control was found sufficient. It's going to lastly say that either this control has an exception noted, meaning that the testing didn't check the boxes, like maybe one person might have, you know, kind of like failed it, or two people, whatever that number is. But whatever number that was, if it's 25 people, not all 25 people did whatever that was, whether it was like an access review, whether it was security awareness training. That's one of the wins I see the most of, like somebody not completing like training. It's mm-hmm. like a lot of the times where those type of situations don't bother me as much because it can happen, but it's not like a company saying like they found like a particular control where encryption wasn't, you know, done, or a system wasn't patched or something like that. Those are the ones that has me like, should we really still be working with y'all? And then the last part is really like when they have these responses where it says that it wasn't tested this particular period. And I think to myself, I'm like, I get it. It's kind of weird because if you're working with an assessor and you are supposed to be doing pen testing in November, but your assessor comes in August, you know, you might have done pen testing last time. Like you can show that, but you can't show that based off of this current year. So they aren't able to make that determination, which kind of can be a little bit scary when, you know, I look at those type of reports, because to me, it doesn't say that they're doing it. It says that it seems like we're doing it, but we're putting a trust in the assessors to get the job done. But the report doesn't give that full trust to me to be able to say like, all right, they're doing it. Yeah. I just rambled a lot. Sorry.
No, that's y'all. Good. That's good. Cause I was thinking about like regular stuff. When you talk about third party risk or things like that, and I thought about like something simple of, people doing business with somebody, regular person, or say you got a business. Mm-hmm. And you're the business, and then this other people, they're a money delivery business. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you kind of do your background on them, and then you figure mm-hmm. out, hey, these people take the money to the house, and they don't lock their door at night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That could be a risk, right? Absolutely. So it's like if we equate that to, hey, we do business with these people, but they ain't got multi-factor authentication.
Facts.
They don't got defense in depth. Mm-hmm. They don't have conditional access policies.
Mm-hmm.
So if these people get breached, we got to look.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that reminds me of, as yesterday happened, Affleck reported that, you know, they suffered a breach.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, they say people didn't get much. They didn't think it was a ransomware incident, but they did get hit by Scatter Spider.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's tough. Like I said, I mean, I know you had talked about that one. You know, I think one that, you know, another conversation that came out was, you know, about the passwords this week. And so
I found something on that too. They said that wasn't new data.
What?
Yeah, I got the let me see. I think I got the article up now. Because everybody went to go make content and stuff about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked it up and I was like, let me see this, because you know,
in my 16 billion is a lot of credentials.
Yes, that says no. The 16 billion credential leak is not a new data breach.
Mm.
And I'll just read it because this is what I love to do.
For sure.
News broke today about one of the largest data breaches in history, sparking wide media covers filled with warnings and fear-mongering. However, it appears to just be a compilation of previously leaked credentials stolen by info stealers, exposing data breaches and via credential stuffing attacks. And I'm with that too, because my cousin, he hit me. He was like, hey, man, what am I supposed to do? Because he's seen the thing. I was mm-hmm, like... Mm-hmm. I was like, well, my apps have notified me that any breaches happened. And mm-hmm. I'm like, I use password managers, and they so long. Like if they got them, they can have them. Mm-hmm, but I'm saying they're gonna have to get the other part to log in.
Facts.
And so that's why I wasn't really just I didn't rush to go make a video on it because I was like you said, 16 billion is a lot. Ain't no way possible. Like some stuff would be going down to 16 billion. Like everybody would be having to change password. Businesses, professional people, everybody. So they said, let's see what else, because I don't want to read the whole thing.
Yeah, no, take your time.
Cyber News, which discovered the briefly exposed data sets of compiled credentials, stated it was stored in a format commonly associated with InfoStealer malware, though they did not share samples. And InfoStealer is malware that attempts to steal credentials, cryptocurrency wallets, and other data from infected devices. Over the years, InfoStealers have become a massive problem, leading to breaches worldwide. This type of malware impacts both Windows and Macs, and when executed, will gather all the credentials it can find, store it on the device, and save them in what's called a log. They're really getting down to the basics, but hey. An InfoStealer log is generally an archive containing numerous text files and other stolen data. The text file contains lists of credentials stolen from browsers, files, and other applications. All right, so there's a lot of stuff. This is like, and this is another reason, like the episodes where it's not interview style.
Yeah.
While we share the screen, it's because we show the people what we're reading in the article and what this stuff will look like.
Facts. Yeah, yeah. Nah, that's good insight.
If someone is infected with an InfoStealer and has 1,000 credentials saved in their browser, the InfoStealer will steal them all and store them in a log. These logs are then uploaded to the threat actor where the credentials can be used to further attacks or sold on cybercrime marketplaces. Now, I do know, I believe recently Google did something to kind of update their security from InfoStealers, like stealing people's saved passwords within the browser. But it's another reason why I just don't store mine in the browser.
No, facts. Like, of course not.
I just use my extensions with like Dashlane.
Exactly.
And I use Dashlane because they never been hacked. So I remember I reached out to somebody from Dashlane. If you see this, get at me. Sponsor us.
Tell the people, tell a friend to tell a friend.
But yeah, I'm trying to get to the crux of what they said, like how they got to the rest of this information.
It's crazy though.
Yeah, it's something I probably me and Destiny will probably cover or whatever, just to inform the people some more so we can actually like go through it. But it will be forever. But no, I mean, between that Aflac and then what you and I were talking about earlier with the AI thing, I got the post up here. Now this is one I actually did want to read.
Word up.
And this is one I said like, hey, like if we were at the company, let's say I'm on IR, you and GRC, what are we thinking about
facts.
Here?
Yeah, yeah.
So she posted this 3 days ago. She said, it finally happened. The first confirmed zero-click command injection against a production AI assistant, CVE-2025-32711. Cybersecurity researchers discovered it last week. No phishing leak, no malware, just a prompt engineered to silently trigger Microsoft 365 Copilot into leaking private organizational data. I know what you may be thinking. Aren't all prompt injection attacks technically zero click? Traditional AI prompt attacks usually rely on user interaction, tricking someone into pasting a malicious prompt or clicking a poison email. CVE-2025-32711 didn't need any of that. The attacker sent the prompt via email, calendar, etc. that Copilot processed silently in the background. No clicks, no visibility, and no other action. To be clear, the way this works is the email calendar invite arrives in the victim's inbox, no read, click required. Sitting in the user's inbox is enough because Copilot ingested it as part of its background context processing. Microsoft has patched it, but the lesson is bigger than a CVE. AI pipelines need to treat all input as hostile. Context boundaries need to be enforced, not assumed. Prompt handling is a user experience layer and a security function. For those deploying Copilot or similar tools, audit the blast radius of your AI workflows. Most organizations still don't fully understand what data their AI assistant agents can see, let alone what might trigger them to share it. If you like keeping your company's intellectual property private and you have artificial intelligence deployed in your environment, read this post 2 times. The next wave of breaches will probably come from AI behaving exactly as designed, but not as expected. So we all have to spend our thinking around risk management and governance as we continue to enable business innovation with AI. So I feel like this is a good use case and stuff like this.
Absolutely.
These are like the type of questions when I'm on interviews and I write my questions out.
Yeah.
I asked, like, I had an interview, I forgot what it was, a couple of months ago, but
okay.
Funny enough, I asked them, hey, how are y'all handling third-party risk management? We was talking about. And it was like crazy. We just had a meeting about that today. And so I'm always trying to find stuff that's currently going on. So I can ask it. So I'm like, okay, this person's engaged with Security News. And this is how this is how I answer the question, hey, how do I stay informed about security threats or whatever? Because they typically sometimes they want to ask that. I was like, this is how. But in our scenario, UGRC, I'm on the blue team.
Love it.
We got our security engineers over there, our vendors. What are you thinking?
Well, that's a really good question. I would say I recently did some content creation revolving around cyber, around AI, some of the drawbacks and some of the different security challenges. I think that at the end of the day, AI is a tool, right? It's a tool. You know, the buzzword has been going around quite some time because a lot of companies are looking to adopt it into their organizations. But AI has been around for quite some time. And with it being a tool, you know, malicious actors are, you know, taking advantage of the opportunity to say, you know, this can be another entry point for us to, you know, perform a data breach to your organization. I will say that a lot of the groups that I've, you know, supported most recently are more in the public sector space. So there is a slow, you know, start when it comes to, you know, adopting AI to the organizations. A lot of people aren't as trigger happy to use this new tool because we have to consider the risk management behind it. And I made a point earlier, you know, security is normally an afterthought. We think about, you know, the shiny new tools that's going to help us do things better. It's going to help us, you know, save time, save money, you know, but at the end of that, you know, at what cost, right? And we have to always ask ourselves, you know, with the decisions we make, was it really worth it? I think that AI is going to be something that's going to continue to be around for some time, as of cybersecurity is as well. But the sophistication of the attacks is just going to get more crazier and crazier, not to take a step away from the, you know, the use case that you just proposed. But, you know, within my research, I'm learning that, you know, even someone that doesn't have any cybersecurity experience can create a sophisticated, you know, phishing campaign to make someone that is well aware to actually like click on a phishing link. You know, they can, you know, launch like ransomware without having that typical background to do so, just because AI is a tool that they can kind of create that aspect.
Yeah. So I'm glad you said that, because for years I've been telling people how, like, hey, every industry is not gung ho on introducing AI, because as much as you can get from productivity, you bring the risk.
Right.
Like this instance, it's functioning how it's supposed to. Now, typically you will hope your tool, like either like a Proofpoint or Momcast or something, would catch this. But it's only going to catch it if it deems it to be malicious. So sometimes Proofpoint will say, oh, this is an unknown sender. I'm just going to hold it right here in limbo because I don't recognize it. And you got other services like we use, like Proofpoint Tap and everything else. We'll like say, hey, go check this out. And we don't know what this supposed to be is. And then that's when, you know, we can actually look at it and say, what's this calendar invite from that? So typically if your tools work is fine, which I think this is why a company like Proofpoint, you got Microsoft, they got like Threat Explorer and all these things else. So as they study AI and they upgrade their tools, that should help out with that. Then let's take it a step further. Let's say somebody is using LinkedIn, and so they figure out, oh, you work with so-and-so company on the GRC team. They figure out who your manager is. So now they some type of way are able to utilize AI to send you like an email spoofing like whatever your manager's email is. So you think you're talking to your manager. And now they say, hey, you got time for, you know, a quick call, join the call. It may be figure out how they do something on the background, trying to put something on your machine. But not only that, now with the advances in AI, they got a fake AI person look just like your boss.
Deep fakes.
And sound like them.
Crazy.
And so now you think you talking to them. So I was like, now you got to tell people, hey, get up, turn around, do all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But when it comes to all this different like AI stuff. So it's just like I said, people are only looking at the part of like, okay, we don't have to hire as many people. It's not, but I'm like, okay, you can, we just seen iRobot. You can keep on playing games if you want to.
Yeah, facts.
Or you have companies like Klarna said, well, hey, this AI stuff ain't go the way we thought it would. We got to hire people again.
Yeah.
Or you have like, you know, they want to use, the AI a lot of times when you call into customer service and stuff. I'm like, bro, they only understand these things. I did not understand you. Send you to an agent. Then you only got like four agents.
Yeah. The bias behind it is crazy. Like,
it's just not at a level yet. That's why I was like, people should like, now that use case is pretty cool. And so now you have to figure out too, it's like, okay, what is the reason behind even having Copilot in our, you know, enterprise environment?
Facts. Yeah. And to that point, like I said, AI is something that is a slow implementation from the public sector standpoint. You know, they've been hearing about it for quite some time, but, you know, as the government typically moves, they're not going to, you know, jump on it first time it comes around versus, like, I've worked in private sector as well, you know, and it's not a hard task to get someone on board to, you know, start working with the new best thing because they see how it can impact their organization. So I talked about the public sector standpoint. If it was a private sector company that's looking to bring this AI capability on, and there's no workaround within it, you know, from a GRC standpoint, I'm looking at doing a risk assessment on this particular, you know, instance. Have I done a lot of risk assessments on AI? I'm not even going to lie to y'all. That hasn't been my thing, right? But it's probably going to be more opportunities with doing some of that stuff in the future.
Bro, you low-key should just apply to, like, when I say, like, Microsoft probably had, like, 50 roles for, like, AI governance.
Word.
Roles, I promise you, bro. They literally, like, the experience you didn't need was, like, crazy. So, like, people like you with that background, that's what they was looking for. Because that's what they trying to prepare for and help out with all their different customers and stuff that they got going on.
Microsoft, get at me. but yeah, just the last point I just wanted to make was just that within that, it's about the risk assessment, but it's also about having the right policies in place too. Like you got to have, you know, and I love the type of work that, you know, GRC has introduced me to because we're not into the nitty gritty, but we consider everything at a high level to ensure that it impacts not only the business, but the people that work for that particular business. And those particular people have to be able to abide by some type of standard or people are going to do any and everything they want to do. There's not going to be any structure in your organization. So creating those policies to say, if we're adopting this particular tool into our organization, then these are the type of, you know, things that everyone needs to abide by. And then, you know, down into top of that, you know, we got to have, like, you know, people like yourself, you know, from that blue team perspective to be able to ensure that AI is doing what it's supposed to do. You know, I think it's crazy because when you look at it, I look at AI as like a tool of knowledge, excuse me, a lake of knowledge is what I meant to say. Like, you know, whatever you tell it, it's going to spit back something based off of that. So my two cents to everyone I talk to is to not put any sensitive information out there because it's going to go into that pool and God forbid somebody said, tell me about Jane Doe, you know, they're going to be able to spit that back out because you have misused the tool for what it wasn't supposed to be, but they didn't tell you you couldn't use it to that degree, right? It's about having conversations and listening to, you know, type of conversations like these to help you determine, like, what you should, whether or not what you shouldn't be doing, you know?
Yeah, and that also reminded me, like, as I was driving here, I thought about, it was stupid, but it had me thinking about, like, years ago, using MySpace, being on the internet and stuff like that. Nobody, like, grandparents, them, they don't know nothing, like, how to be safe on that. So I was like, like, who's, like, training up the kids now because they got so much access to technology. What to put on there, what not to put on there, who to talk to, who not to talk to. When it comes to AI, all these different things, like, this is their reality now. They finna be watching commercials with, like, AI people and stuff or believing the stuff that they showing with AI.
Absolutely.
And it's going to come to that time where now you got to educate them. So
no, agree.
I was going to ask you real quick, too. Did you make another salary jump from going from working in the SOC to working in compliance?
So, not really. And that's crazy to say. So, those three roles I talked about before, from the product marketing all the way to the SOC analyst role, were they had some increases in those particular roles that were during my rotation program. When I got out of the program, there wasn't any, like, really big jumps from, you know, the money that I was making. And I think at the time the company was trying to do a better job at, you know, keeping everybody there. So it wasn't really like a lot of, like, increase that year. you know, from that point on, I loved the work that I did. I seen the value in it. But from that point on, I was really, really trying to get into consulting, and none of those doors was opening up. So I actually had got an opportunity to, you know, start working at one of the big four, Ernst & Young. They have a strategy arm called Parthenon. And it was like management consulting. So I was like, oh, okay. I didn't really know about like how consulting was broken down those days. But they was like, yeah, you with the big leagues. And I'm like, oh, okay. So, you know, when I made that particular jump, I was able to like double my salary.
Were you in Georgia still?
So funny, yeah. So I left y'all in the story on that. My bad. So Jersey went back to Virginia for 6 months during COVID because I didn't know exactly what was going to happen. When I was in compliance, I was in Dallas. So I had been in Dallas. I was in Dallas for 2 years, but I was with that team for a little bit over a year, I believe. So about 5 years at AT&T, and then, you know, EY, things worked out, and, you know, was there for like a year and a half.
So you was going to that building?
Yeah, there? Yeah. A lot of the work that we did was remote, though. Okay. Oh, wait. So for AT&T or EY?
EY.
Oh, yeah. So a lot of things were remote. Even with EY, like we went into the office like very, very seldomly. So I started with them back in 2022. Great company and everything. A lot of a lot of people say if you get into consulting, you can literally do like anything. And I really, from that point on, knew that really the sky was the limit because I'm on engagements doing like security maturity assessments, working with, you know, CISOs and people that are leading the security program to help them, you know, find those gaps and really like help them make the better decisions for their group. So I enjoyed my time with them for sure.
Dope. So, I mean, you went from, I'm calculating 90, 95, you mentioned with like 180, mm-hmm. 185, mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah.
I almost had a chance to like, you know, the funny thing is, like, as you keep on progressing, you start figuring out, like, all these different avenues companies use mm-hmm. to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I was, like, this close last year to working with EY as in, like, doing a C2C for Airbnb.
Oh, nice.
And I made it to N, and they wanted me, but the contract fell through. I was like, man.
That's crazy.
Crazy thing is I turned another contract down to work with Otis Elevators for the Airbnb because it was, like, 20 more an hour.
Dope.
So
okay.
I was just like, I can't afford to probably not try to see this dude. Because once the person said, yeah, they like you, they move you to the end.
Yeah.
Because our interview was like super technical. And then we was like to the point where the dude was like, yo, so tell me what you would do with this stuff. And like, if you didn't have the certain tools you have, how would you do it brick by brick?
Mm-hmm.
And we just kept on digging.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what a lot of people before me wasn't able to do. So
yeah, no, that's tough.
But something else I didn't ask, like, about the compliance ERC role, like,
yeah,
what type of softwares, platforms, things that you have to learn how to use?
Yeah. So, crazy enough, it's a lot of GRC tools out there today. You know, coming from my background, I've been able to, you know, work with different tools. But I know, like, ServiceNow is, like, a bigger tool that, you know, a lot of people are leveraging. We were starting to work with something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, some groups use Archer.
I was about to ask about Archer.
Yeah. So I've seen some familiarity with that as well. When I first started out with the GRC team that I was working with, there wasn't a lot of like tooling capabilities. You know, everything we pretty much used was free 99. So I remember we used Trello. And they had like a free subscription. That's more like a tasking, trying to like, you know, ensure that, you know, you have like a full agenda of different things to get done and it's getting done because you could assign it to different people in your team. My team was very small, so it worked out. We used, you know, the ticketing system like Jira. You know, that was pretty cool.
Did you guys have to do stuff like agile, waterfall type stuff? Or like, how would y'all projects go up there for y'all from a GRC perspective?
So with us, I would say it was more agile. We kind of like figured it out on the fly for sure. But yeah, like when it came down to like implementing different things and like I'll give you an example, like the user access reviews was like one of the things I had to do. We had to understand, well, you know, what are the requirements? You know, what type of controls does this really connect with from the different standards that we need to adhere to? And really just figuring out like what type of documentation is necessary to be able to be sufficient for those type of controls. So, I mean, a good policy will at least get you, you know, a good amount of the way, you know, having that in place. But being able to, outside of the policies, being able to show that the work is actually being done, like that crazy spreadsheet that you talked about, is was like one of those other aspects of showing like how the work is getting done, you know. So we did a lot of things like agile style and really just trying to continue to go through the cycle in the different sprints as we was trying to, you know, get things achieved.
That's dope. No, for real, because I'm like, it's funny how so many people know, like, people talk about compliance. Man, most of them things done in Excel. Mm-hmm. And I know I did GRC for JPMC, so, like, okay. We used a lot of Excel,
yeah.
SQL, mm-hmm. Databases, mm-hmm. Archer, and some other tools.
Yeah, so yeah,
it
yeah.
It was funny when, like, every time I see a GRC job, they talk about Archer.
Yeah, so. Yeah. No, that's it's a heavy tool in the industry. And I know they have a lot of other tools out there today that, you know, have those same capabilities. But, you know, as people, we like to see past performance. We like to see other groups that have been successful with them. So a lot of those larger corporations still continue to be at the top of the chain because a lot of people can hear how well they've done over the years.
Cool. So one of the things you talk about when you're trying to get into consulting, how you pretty much try to skill up. And so how do you feel about, I know you got your CISSP, your CISM, and I want to make sure I put the other one right. CCISO, is that right?
Yeah, the CCISO.
That's what it's...
you good.
No, bro.
You good.
Because that's not one I see all the time. Yeah, so when I seen those by EC Council,
yeah,
I just read it as CC.
Yeah.
Like CCC. Okay, CCISO.
Yeah. So as we're still going through the storyline, I will say that in my time of getting my certifications, I had quite a lot of time on my hands because I got impacted by a layoff when I was at Ernst & Young. You know, from there, I try to understand, like, what was it that I wanted to do next? I had this mindset and mentality that I wanted to walk into another role that I was able to not only be an asset and a value, but actually be able to show, you know, what I was doing during my time off. You know, it reminded me of, and we were talking about this earlier, how like music and sports go hand in hand. And I think about like artists when they're like making music, you know, they have those off seasons of being in the studio to produce like, you know, great music. And then when you have like from a sports standpoint, I play basketball. So that's a lot of the sports I continue to tap into. Being able to look at, you know, some of the folks when they're off season, like they're continuing to grind out. Like they might not be playing. And, you know, from a fan standpoint, we might not be able to see them in a game, but our thoughts is that they're continuously working, the great players, the ones that's like really getting after it, those that's in the headlines, like there's really no days off for them. You know, they're doing something to continue to better themselves. And so I took that same mentality and put it into cybersecurity. Like you said, like a lot of things like typically aligned, it's just different industries that it's leveraged in. So I said, you know what, forget this. I'm going to get these certifications. Start off really with the CC, Certified in Cybersecurity. Wasn't really hard for me because I had, you know, that background in cybersecurity already. But I look at these certs as building blocks. You know, some people look to get that CISSP first, and it's like, you know, what work have you done first prior to it? So, you know, the requirements for
CISSP. Now you're preaching now.
Yeah. The requirements for the CISSP is to have a minimum of 5 years. And if you don't have that, you'll be associate of the CISSP, which means that you have the knowledge, but you don't actually have like the certification to say you have it without being an associate. So like I said, did the CC, did the Security Plus next. A lot of people talk about the Security Plus when they're trying to get into it. And my advice to a lot of everyone is while the CC is still free at this time, you know, start off with that. You know, I know that was probably something you was going to ask me, but you know, why we're on the topic, start off with the CC. Like, why not? You know, it's free. You're not investing too much into it right now. It's a certification.
What's the CC?
Certified in Cybersecurity.
So is that the IC Squared joint?
Yep. It's a free one. Yeah. It comes with the study materials. It comes with the voucher. Like, all of it is still, like, free right now. And I tell people that are looking to pivot into cybersecurity or even like been in cybersecurity, but trying to start their journey on getting like certification, it creates a good foundation for you. So then after that, did the Security Plus aspect, A lot of people talk about Security Plus being the beginner's aspect. That has changed over time. I think that since it's a little bit more applicable versus maybe 20 years ago, it might have been a definition test. You know, it's something that is a little bit more of a challenge. But, you know, when you have like that CC, you can kind of look at these certifications as building blocks. So after Security Plus, did the CISM, studied for probably like 3 months doing it. Funny enough, I actually failed it the first time.
Really?
Not funny, but I failed it the first time, felt defeated. But, you know, that resilience, you know, having to continue to go back for, you know, the things that you really want. I took it the next time and I passed it. And so I knew I was cooking with high grease when I got the CISM. I was like, yeah, like we locked in now. So after that, I was like, yo, the CISSP is up next. What you going to do? And I'm about 3 months locked in. It's funny, we having this conversation right now. I was going through my social media, and sometimes it gives you like some of those memories. They call them the memories. And I remember like I did a post about like me locking in with the CISSP around this time, and I studied for like 3 months. You know, I was like locked in. Like it was not. I used to carry my book with me. Like it was nothing. Nothing that I wasn't doing to try to get that certification. Passed it on the first time, glory to God. And I was like, okay, well,
man,
you're doing it.
My thing with it, so like I've had it on my resume in progress for about a year or two.
Yeah.
So I've got my study material. I went and got me another notebook, because when I like to study for tests, I like to write stuff down that I don't know, because it stick with me.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out my best way to, I'm trying to figure out the best materials to use it, because I like, how I like to do it is I take the initial whatever test it is, and then show me what domains I'm not the best in. That way I could just go focus on them versus having to try to make my mind be excited to read stuff I already know.
Right.
Because that's hard for me to do. That's why sometimes it's hard for me to study some stuff, because like I already know this. Just show me what I don't know and then let me put it together.
That is the tough part of it. Like it was a lot of times of, for me, I think I might have talked to you about this earlier, but like when I'm committed to something, I can't mentally, I can't take myself away from it. I told myself when I was going through the studying aspect, like it was a lot of like doing things I didn't want to do, like reading up on risk management, even though I've delved into risk management and know it to a great degree. But being able to make sure that if I'm gonna do this, I need to lock in and like do everything like as if it was like my first time. So that's probably like my most unenjoyable piece. But like as for like some of the tools I had used, it's one called Bosun. They have a really, really good online piece with like their testing, because like from my understanding, the tests of the Bosun test is supposed to be more complex than the actual CISSP itself.
Yeah.
So it pushes your mind to help you kind of critically think through some of those problems. And so when you get to the actual CISSP, you know, you can, you'd be well equipped to kind of answer some of those questions. What else did I use? I used, you know,
I got Wiz Labs right now.
Which one?
I got Wiz Labs.
Okay.
And I can't remember if I bought some on Udemy or not, because I know like it's not the same thing, but like when I was studying for like I got like the entry level cloud certs like a couple of years ago.
Sure.
Well, really, with 2021 and 2020, so four or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Those tests were harder than the actual tests I took for Pearson.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, exactly. That's what I need. As long as it's harder than that, and it, like, and I'm cracking the 90s or whatever, I said, I'm good, because this is harder.
Facts. Yeah. And so the other tests, or the other ones I did through ISC2, they had, I think it was, like, 90 days or 180 days. They had, like, some type of study material that you don't have to pay for the full thing. That it was, like, I guess a little bit discounted at the time. So that really helped out, because when you look at questions through the actual vendor that is proposing and doing the actual test, then you have a better understanding like what type of questions they're going to kind of ask. Yeah. It might not be identical, but you get the feeling behind it. And with a lot of these tests is really understanding like how are they going to ask you the questions.
And that's what makes CompTIA stuff harder than it has to be, the way they ask the question.
Because
I'll say, like you was talking about earlier about Sec Plus, I'll say, I don't think Sec Plus got nothing on CISA Plus. That joint had me in there sweating.
What? It's crazy.
For real, bro. I'm like,
And
I had experience at the time taking it.
Yeah.
That's why it's one of the tests I don't really tell people to take without experience, because to me, it's a test you should have experience for.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, some of those avenues were really good to help me like figure it out. Of course, I did the book too, and they have like this little code where I forgot what the website is for the code. But you know, those, you know, practice tests are really helpful too. So anytime you're doing a studying for any type of certification, I always recommend at least two different perspectives, two different resources to give you a better understanding. And hopefully one of them is like the actual vendor itself. But outside of that, you know, being able to go with another reputable source should be able to, you know, help you succeed in taking some of those exams. But did that one, did associate CCSO. And so, yeah, I am mapping out, you know, what my next thing is going to be. I was having a conversation yesterday. I was like, I kind of miss like when I had locked in for these type of things. It's a weird feeling, but I think last year I was just so locked in. Like it was just my life, just studying and more studying and more studying. So I think it's time for me to like invest into more. I know, not that I know a lot about it, but the CMMC space is something that's going to really continue to grow with learning that a lot of industries like that have to be mandated. You know, I think it's by October or something like that. But, you know, it's a short period of time. So it's a big, heavy market for a lot of people that are already in that particular space to, you know, bring in new, you know, clientele.
Yeah, man, I'm looking to give me a certification with Wiz as well.
Okay.
So Wiz just did like a cloud fundamental cert they have. So sure. That one and maybe some other ones. Cause like certs like that, if you get them, you can get a job just working with Wiz because everybody ain't got access to it. So
facts.
Gatekeeping things.
Facts. Yeah.
But man, I wanted to ask you this.
Talk to me.
Got two part question.
All right.
How would you instruct someone to get in the GRC? And the first person is a person with no experience.
Okay.
And then the second person would be a person that had a background similar to you.
Okay. Getting into GRC, well, yeah, that's a good question. I think I would answer that. All right, so separately, someone that doesn't have experience in cybersecurity, I'm going to advise them to look into the CC, Certified in Cybersecurity certification. I'm just a firm believer that if you're looking to get into a space that's new, I believe in cost efficiency. I don't want you to pay too much money into something that you may or may not even like. You know, like we've probably seen people that we work with that wanted to get into cybersecurity, and once they did, they didn't enjoy it as much, you know. So whatever you do, just make sure it makes sense. So I'm probably going to tell them that's the first step for them. From that point on, they want to start focusing more on GRC. By that time, they already made an investment, right? So I would say Security Plus is going to be the gold standard because although the CC is a newer certification, not a lot of people know about it. A lot of people know IC2 or IC2, but not a lot of people know that particular certification. So I want that gold standard for you to be able to say when you're having conversations with someone who's looking at your resume, they see Security Plus, they know you're legit. So those two certifications are like one of the avenues that I would take like from your first mark to GRC. Secondly, I would say, which is very, very, very not really said, but networking. Network is extremely important. Talking to GRC experts to continue to gain their knowledge in the space, you know, going to different conferences like the ISACAs and the IC2s and, you know, some of the other different entities and meeting some of these different folks and getting a chance to just shake hands with people in that space gives you a better perspective of GRC because they normally do like monthly meetings where they have to present on a particular topic. And, you know, for those particular groups, I know AI is really big and heavy, but a lot of the times people will talk about, you know, things that are, you know, within the GRC, the governance or the risk or the compliance aspect. So you're going to get something from that at some point in time. And like I said, the soft skill aspect is really important. So you got the certifications, you got the soft skills. And then the next part of it all is really just understanding what type of role in GRC do you want to do, right? Because cybersecurity is so vast, but GRC is vast as well. Being able to understand what type of transferable skills have you been able to do in the past that you can leverage to talk through it. So for example, you know, for someone who might have been security guard. I'm just throwing something out there. Like, they had to manage, like, you know, visitor logs to understand, like, mm-hmm. who's coming in and who's leaving. You know, that's the same thing they're doing in cybersecurity, like, looking at the user access reviews, people that are, you know, have permissions, they're coming into the organization and, you know, able to have different access to different systems. So it's funny enough how a lot of things that we see in the real world kind of can transfer into cybersecurity. But being able to look and latch on to what's being done in a cybersecurity standpoint, looking at what you've been able to do and kind of like merge it to. I would say those are pretty like probably like the top three, the transferable skills, the soft skills, and then the certifications are probably like the top three for someone that doesn't have that background. If you already have that background, I would probably still advise on all of the above. I think that, not all of the above, because you already have access, but you already have, you know, you understand cybersecurity, or you've been in IT to some degree. Certifications, real heavy. Soft skills, networking, real heavy. I would say from that point on, if you're already in that space, I would say definitely more and more pouring into the networking aspect, because you're already in there. So somebody knows that you're capable of doing the work. And I think where the gap is right now today is that nobody wants to take a chance on anyone anymore. People like to see you having certifications and experience already. But if you don't have that, nobody's willing to really vouch or really sit down and really take the time to really show you what needs to be done. But it's like the caveat is understanding if we have people that, cybersecurity is a growing industry and we need to grow with the times, and meaning to increase the cybersecurity professionals, how do we bridge that gap to ensure that these professionals are ready when, you know, when an attack happens? I ain't say if it happens, but when it happens, right? So, but like I said, those first two components are really keen in on the certifications and in the networking aspect. And then really just being able to tell your story, because if you've already been in cybersecurity or if you've already been in GRC, or not even GRC because you're trying to get into it, but if you're in cybersecurity or IT, you're able to, like, you know, maybe shadow sometimes with other different groups or be able to understand the work that they do, so that you can kind of have those conversations to say, you know, from a GRC standpoint, I can do it as well.
Yeah. I'm surprised one thing you didn't tell the newbie to do is to get the Google cybersecurity certificate.
So I only tell people to do things that I've done. I don't take away from the Google cybersecurity certificate. I think I've heard a lot of great things about it. I know that there is a cost associated with it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but it's pretty cheap. It's like you can pay, I think, like you get a 2 weeks free or like $14 or something like that. But it's pretty much affordable. And I've been through it because I had to make a video about it for Coursera. Yeah. But it introduced you to multiple domains. Nice. And the reason why I mentioned this, because like you said, you might get into cybersecurity, you don't like it. Mm-hmm. So if you get multiple domains, you can get access to, say, okay, I want to fixate on this one. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole reason behind me saying, hey, you should go look into that, because you just don't know what you don't know. So somebody kind of show it to you is different. Mm-hmm. And one of the friends of the show, she actually works for Google. She does data privacy.
Nice.
She actually made a cameo on the course.
That's dope. Yeah. So, I mean, you have those different avenues to get your kickstart in cybersecurity. And then once you're in cybersecurity, able to understand, like, what's my lane? And I think that's where over time you start to really figure it out. It's not going to be, you know, soon as you start off, but over time you're like, all right, maybe I want to be more technical. So maybe I'm interested in doing the ethical hacking, or, you know, I might want to be on the other side of it doing some of the, you know, security monitoring, or, you know, I might be like me and might want to do like some of the GRC stuff. You know, who knows? So it's so many different things. You got identity access management, you have incident response. You know, you have vulnerability management. I mean, the list really continues, and, you know, really the world's your oyster, right? Yeah. You know, so everybody's got to start from somewhere, and where you start isn't where you have to leave, you know, or end up. So, you know, just start from somewhere, get into it, learn more about the other spaces, and, you know, get to where better serves you. You know, hate for somebody to get into a job that they don't want to log in every day. You know, they hate being there.
I've been there.
You know, yeah, facts, me too. Yeah.
But have you thought about going to law school?
I've not thought about going to law school. It's funny you asked that. I actually, so why you asked me that first?
Because a lot of people don't look at how much the law aspect or counsel gets paid in security companies or any company because they got to go over those contracts. And there, a lot of times when it's a big breach happens, you got to bring in legal in. They got to do all these things. Right. And they're looking through all these things. You're not going to trial every day, but you're still making good money. Yeah. And it's really a 9-to-5 to you.
Yeah.
And so that's why I thought about it. Because we don't talk about a lot of times people doing law and cybersecurity.
Yeah, we should. Legal counsel roles are definitely, I've seen some of them out there posted. And like I said, it's a lot of value in there because going back to the C and GRC, that compliance aspect is really key. You know, when you think about, you know, bringing on a new company, think about a data breach happening, you know, you got to always like, you know, involve your legal team to some capacity. And, you know, contractual agreements are, you know, word is bond, you know, when those things typically happen, right? So, yeah, I think legal counsel is a really good role for someone that has been seasoned and wants to kind of merge the two between law and cyber. When you said law school, I was like, nah, that wasn't what I was thinking. But I have, and this is, you know, I think that a lot of people have been able to get into cybersecurity without having a degree. Like I said, my degree was in computer science. I come from a background where I thought I would never go back to school. I'm looking to enroll to actually get my MBA. And that might be a different focus because a lot of people that are in cybersecurity look to get their master's in cybersecurity. But like my aspect was I already knew or got the technical aspect when I did computer science. And so from there, I wanted to diversify my portfolio and being able to, you know, understand the business and how cybersecurity is supposed to enable the business. You know, thinking about, you know, at one point in time, if I'm able to, you know, optimize a business, right, being able to have those skills. And even as I have aspirations to be CISO or support a company from a CISO perspective, being able to have that understanding of how cybersecurity meets the business needs. So I'm trying to do the groundwork right now. The certifications was one part of it, but I think the MBA will take me to another lane of being able to really have those conversations with C-suite executives and really be able to be that trusted advisor for organization.
Yeah, I know for me, like I said, that's why when I went to get a master's, I didn't do cyber because I was already in cyber. So I just did technology management.
Yeah, okay.
Because
okay.
I pretty much did a lot of different diverse type of classes and some of the stuff I see come up and either calls or something like that. I was like, oh yeah, I remember we did enterprise architecture and all this other stuff, which is like just some cool stuff to do. So
So I mean, like I said, it's a lot of opportunity out there, and I'm just continue to trying to figure out how to navigate it, right? You know, like all these different breaches that happen day in and day out. So, you know, you need that job security, 100%.
It's always something to need. So, real quick, what's something I didn't ask you that you thought I would have asked you?
I don't know. I mean, I think I covered a lot of it already. Like I said, I talked about, like, my aspirations of, like, where I wanted to see myself. I thought that might have been one of the ones you might have asked, but I think I kind of covered it a little bit more.
Yeah, because that's the thing. I was going to like, you know, what's next?
Yeah. I mean, we'll see how things go, right? I think that CISO has always been the goal, being able to be in leadership in cybersecurity, being able to lead a team, build a security program. Those are like all the things that my focus is. I think that for me, at some point in time, I want to work with some of the groups that don't have that capital to have like a sound cybersecurity program, right? So what about, and like I talked about earlier, cybersecurity is a modern day self-defense, right? So, you know, it's not a group that doesn't need it. It's everybody needs it. I was in like a meeting and just kind of like overhearing how there was electrical company that was in the middle of nowhere that got hit with a cyber attack from China. And you think about somewhere in the middle of nowhere and a company that nobody's ever heard of, you're like, why them? You know, and you know, Unfortunately, when it comes to cybersecurity, it's
anybody can get it.
Anybody can get it for sure, for sure. Being able to work with groups like those small and mid-sized businesses, those startups, those nonprofits, those groups that, you know, can't really hire some of the, you know, the groups that you're really seeking as larger providers, and being able to consult with them, being able to help them, engage them. I think that some other stuff is probably doing more guest speaking opportunities to be able to share the awareness and spread the word about cybersecurity. And then I will say being able to teach cybersecurity, being able to pour back into, you know, the different professionals or aspiring professionals, those that are looking to, you know, create a good life for themselves and really create an impact to change the world. So, like I said, it's always a dream, right? It was all a dream, right? In a magazine. So yeah, I think that I'm on a good track to do some of that stuff in the near future.
That's a bit, man. That's a bit. So where can the listeners, where can they follow you at?
So I got a couple of different handles. I'm going to try to get it right. So for Instagram, we have emcbrideiv_. So that's emcbrideiv_. You can find me on LinkedIn at Irvin McBride IV. So, I mean, those pretty much the top two that I use. I do a little bit of TikTok every now and then with content creation. But, you know, a lot of the gist of the things you'll need to see will be on my Instagram and on my LinkedIn. So looking forward to connecting with you real soon.
Bet, man. Well, appreciated you coming through to chop it up with us today, man.
For sure.
If y'all enjoyed the video, make sure you subscribe and keep tuning in. And like I always say, let's stay textual and we out.
Peace.